Hello, and welcome to the Nauticast podcast, the one true chapter-by-chapter podcast going through A Song of Ice and Fire. I'm one of your hosts, Emmett, also known as Poor Quentin.
I'm your other host, Manu, also known as Manuclear Bomb.
And welcome to the 220th episode of the Nauticast, titled True Kings, an analysis of A Storm of Swords, John 10, in which Jon Snow and the rest of the Night's Watch are saved at the last minute by the arrival of a fiery messianic monarch. No, not Danny. The other one. What's his name?
Young Griff.
That's it. That's the one. So, as always, our spoiler warning. Prepare to be spoiled for all five A Song of Ice and Fire novels, the three Duncan Egg novellas, any histories, any interviews, any Winds of Winter sample chapters, as well as Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon, the TV shows. Anything and everything. So we usually answer a question at the top of our ASWAF episodes that anyone in our Sworn Sword or higher tier can ask us. You can check that out at our Patreon, patreon.com/notacastASOIAF. Go ahead and send in your questions for if you're in the Sworn Sword or higher tier. But we want to take a little time at the top of this episode to talk about a friend of ours that we lost recently, Stephen Adewell. If you're familiar with the Song of Ice and Fire fandom with essays and blogs and podcasts about this story, you're probably familiar with Stephen Adewell. If you're not, he was a history professor. He lived in New York. He was outside the world of Westeros. He was a great activist and union organizer and professor and author. He wore many hats. He was a very accomplished man, very fierce advocate for the causes he believed in, a really inspiring man in life and work across the board. Within our little world, he was the inspiration for many people. He was the source of a lot of great work and a lot of great discussion to be had about this series. He ran the blog Race for the Iron Throne, his WordPress blog, where he went chapter by chapter through A Song of Ice and Fire, which might sound familiar. He's been doing that for quite some time. And he was not only a very well-educated man, well-read in terms of politics and history, which would inform his analysis of the series, but he was also just a terrific writer with a knack for a great bracing, concise turn of phrase that would sum everything up and just leave you winded before moving on to the next part. He definitely was what got me into the Song of Ice and Fire writing, podcasting, blogging, fandom universe. He reeled me in. I just found a link to his stuff in passing. I was a big fan of the books, but that was it. And when we started the Nauticast, we definitely looked to him, to his work as the foundation, not just in terms of the chapter-by-chapter basis, but his overall method of inquiry and analysis was inspiring, like I said. And beyond that, he was just a very good friend and a man whose companionship I treasured. And I'm going to miss him very much.
Yeah, let me just second all of that. I had, you know, the pleasure, the blessing to be one of his friends on Twitter for many years. And like you say, his like impact on the fandom and all the communities he's a part of is like immeasurable. He truly is a titan. He is one of the giants upon whose shoulders we stand. Just talking about his ASWAF stuff to start. Like you say, Race of the Iron Throne is one of the few things like I actually consult to do this podcast. Like, no offense to all the other great creators out in our world, but it's almost like biblical. It's canonical to the analysis of A Song of Ice and Fire, Race of the Iron Throne. You know, I spend a lot of time on this podcast talking about politics and history, and I definitely got that from Stephen, who was able to look at, you know, the events in Westeros and really tie it to things meaningfully to our world, not just like, oh, this is a time where a king died or something else happened. He's like meaningfully taking apart the politics and the socioeconomic factors that go into it. It really is staggering, and it's going to be a loss when we get to chapters where we're not going to have his works to at least look on for inspiration, if not lift ideas from. So,
and I say that with love. Who will we steal from now?
Yes, yes. And like, also his work, he's written a lot about Marvel Comics over the years as well. Everyone should look up his stuff on like Captain America and how he has actually been a comic for social justice for many of his years. There's an idea that's popular in the Marvel and MCU fandom that they should do a Fantastic Four movie set in the 1960s, and I'm pretty sure that's a Stephen Atwell idea from like 2013-2014. He had a very popular blog post that's like, this is how I would introduce the Fantastic Four. So if you see that in that new movie with Pedro Pascal, you know where they got it from. But I think it's really his work outside of these fandoms and these, you know, kind of nerd communities that really is staggering. The work he's done for labor justice and for like meaningful labor justice, as in like labor that's fulfilling fulfilling to the person and also provides for them fully and materially. Good actual labor politics. We throw around the term New Deal Democrat a lot, and a lot of times I use that to describe myself when I don't want to say socialist for a specific audience. But Stephen really lived by those ideals. Like, he looked at the social democratic values of a Roosevelt, of what having a social safety net means, of what having dignified work means, and allowing that work to actually materially provide for you. And he made the case both, you know, theoretically and empirically with data about why this would be better for our country, why this would be better for the working classes, both here and abroad. So as much as I want to gush about his A Song of Ice and Fire and Marvel Comics writing, his work in the realm of academics, economics, and political economies is also worth everyone's time to go check out. And we are just, you know, so much the poorer for not having him be part of our lives and our community anymore.
Well said, sir. And I highly recommend his book, People Must Live by Work, where he mm-hmm. made that case in book-length form about the need for direct job creation and the need to, what he always emphasizes, to expand our political imagination and to not, as I think so many people across the left spectrum do, of kind of having the argument in our heads first and kind of already having defeated ourselves by the time we make our argument. That's something he always advocated is don't make the rights argument for them. Don't cede any rhetorical ground about the uselessness of job creation. It works. And we should be direct and imaginative in making that case. And he always wrote very powerfully about that and with a clear passion for it that really, really came through. And he brought that passion to everything he did. And it's so bittersweet to come to a chapter like this one and wish we had him here mm-hmm. with us to talk about it. Mm-hmm. This is one of so many that I wish I'd gotten to talk to him about. Thankfully, none of us will live to see the Winds of Winter. So that's yeah, comforting, I guess.
Yeah, but, you know, rest in peace and fuck cancer.
Couldn't give a better eulogy than that. So back to fantasy. Back to A Song of Ice and Fire. We're here today to talk about A Storm of Swords, John 10. So let's jump into the synopsis. Jon Snow is being lowered down the wall in a cage, thinking those classic Jon Snow thoughts about how life is a bottomless pit and no one in high school understands him and he would run away and join the army, except he already did that and it sucks. To be fair to Jon, he's got even more reason to be depressed than usual, as he's being sent on the mother of all suicide missions to kill a guy he kinda likes on behalf of some other guys he absolutely hates. The guys he hates are, of course, Jano Slint and Alistair Thorne, who pulled Jon back out of the ice cells after Maester Aemon objected to the whole let's murder Jon Snow for no reason plan. The guy Jon kinda likes is Mance Rayder, who has sent word that he wants to talk. Naturally, says Jano Slint. He knows he'll never get past me, the toughest and bravest child killer in King's Landing. Unfortunately, Mance Rayder is not a literal baby, and so Janos is sending Jon to talk to him, on the basis that Jon's temporary service to the Wildling King will give him credibility in Mance's eyes. Jon points out that, no, actually the opposite is true, Mance will know Jon for a traitor and a liar if he shows back up now, but Alistair Thorne doesn't care, because he knows he finally has Jon trapped. Jon has to do this if he wants to be seen as a good little Night's Watchman, loyal to the cause. Oh, one last thing. Jon isn't actually being sent to negotiate with Mance in good faith. He's being sent to kill him. So here Jon sits in his impossible position. If he refuses to kill Mance, he'll hang for treason. But if he does kill Mance, the Wildlings will kill him. Eventually. Speaking of death, when the cage reaches the ground, Jon has to walk past the corpses of all the Wildlings upon whom he rained death from above in his last chapter. Not all bad, though. At least the local birds get to feast on giant brains. What do they eat when they can't get giant brains? Jon sees that Mance has sent his stoner garage band uncle, aka Tormund, to meet him. Tormund greets Jon warmly, despite the death all around, and they share a drink to the mutual memory of Donal Noy and Mag the Mighty, made equal at the very end. Tormund wonders what happened to Styr, and Jon tells him he's dead, along with Ygritte, for whom they pour another shot. Everyone pours a shot for Ygritte, but not Styr. Fuck that guy. Was it you killed her? My brother. Jon had never learned which one. And hoped he never would. You bloody crows. Tormund's tone was gruff, yet strangely gentle. That long spear stole me daughter. Munda, me little autumn apple. Took her right out of my tent with all four of her brothers around. Torig slept through it, the great lout. And Torwind, well, Torwind the tame, that says all that needs saying, don't it? The young ones gave the lad a fight, though.
And Munda? Asked Jon.
She's my own blood, said Tormund proudly. She broke his lip for him and bit one ear half off. And he has got so many scratches on his back he can't wear a cloak. She likes him well enough, though.
And why not? He don't fight with no spear, you know. Never has. So where do you think he got that name? Ha!
John had to laugh. Even now, even here, Ygritte had been fond of Longspear Rick. He hoped he found some joy with Tormundsmunda. Someone needed to find some joy somewhere.
Damn straight. Drain your drink, everybody.
John calls on Ygritte's voice to help him prepare for death as Tormund leads him through the wildling camp. The free folk stop to stare at the crow, and Mance is waiting for him outside his big fur tent.
"You must be very brave or very stupid, Jon Snow," Mance Rayder said, "to come back to us wearing a black cloak. What else would a man of the Night's Watch wear?"
"Kill him," urged Tarma. "Send his body back up in that cage of theirs and tell him to send us someone else. I'll keep his head for my standard. A turned cloak's worse than a dog."
"I warned you he was false."
Varamyr's tone was mild, but his Shadowcat was staring at John hungrily through slitted gray eyes.
"I never did like the smell of him."
"Well, I don't like the smell of you, buddy."
Tormund feels the same way, but Mance keeps Varamyr around for a reason. He's locked into the eagle formerly possessed by Orel, the guy John killed in the Frostfangs. Varamyr's been using that eagle to spy on the Night's Watch, so Mance knows exactly how few and fragile they are. He calls John into his tent to speak. Inside, Dala is about to give birth, with Val holding her hand. So great. Like John didn't already hate his life, now he might have to kill Mance in front of his wife as she gives birth to their kid. It would take something huge to distract from that. Something like... John sucked in his breath.
A war horn. A bloody great war horn.
"Yes," Mance said, "the horn of winter, that Jormen once blew to wake giants from the earth."
"Okay, yeah, that'll do nicely."
The horn is gigantic, banded with old gold and graven with ancient runes, as per industry standards for magic horns. John asks the obvious question. If Mance has the Horn of Winter, why hasn't he used it? Well, speaking of miracles, Dala gets some dialogue, telling John that sorcery is a sword without a hilt. There is no safe way to grasp it. Mance says he wanted to exhaust all other possibilities first, sending in Styr, using feints and raids to draw the garrison away thanks to Bowen, I make terrible choices for a living marsh, and finally trying to grind down John's little gang of Dickensian orphans through sheer attrition. Even now, Mance says, he has enough reserve forces to overwhelm the Night's Watch on every conceivable frontier.
"Why don't you then?"
John could have drawn Longclaw then, but he wanted to hear what the wildling had to say.
"Blood," said Mance Rayder. "I'd win in the end, yes, but you'd bleed me, and my people have bled enough."
"Your losses haven't been that heavy."
"Not at your hands." Mance studied John's face. "You saw the fist of the first men. You know what happened there. You know what we are facing."
"The others. They grow stronger as the days grow shorter, and the nights colder. First they kill you, then they send your dead against you. The giants have not been able to stand against them. Nor the Thens, the Ice River clans, the Hornfoots. Nor you.
Nor me." There was anger in that admission, and bitterness too deep for words. "Raymond Redbeard, Bale the Bard, Gendolin Gorn, the Horn Lord, they all came south to conquer. But I have come with my tail between my legs to hide behind your wall."
He touched the horn again. "If I sound the Horn of Winter, the wall will fall." So the songs would have me believe. "There are those among my people who want nothing more."
"But once the wall is fallen," Dala said, "what will stop the others?"
Mance gave her a fond smile. "It's a wise woman I've found. A true queen." He turned back to John. "Go back and tell them to open their gate and let us pass. If they do, I will give them the horn, and the wall will stand until the end of days." Open the gate and let them pass. Easy to say, but what must follow? Giants camping in the ruins of Winterfell? Cannibals in the Wolfswood? Chariots sweeping across the Barrowlands? Free folk stealing the daughters of shipwrights and silversmiths from White Harbor? And fishwives off the Stony Shore?
"Are you a true king?"
John asked suddenly. "Never had a crown on my head or set my arse in a bloody throne, if that's what you're asking," Mance replied. "My birth is as low as a man's can get. No septons ever smeared my head with oils. I don't own any castles, and my queen wears furs and amber, not silk and sapphires. I am my own champion, my own fool, and my own harpist. You don't become king beyond the wall because your father was. The free folk won't follow a name, and they don't care which brother was born first. They follow fighters. When I left the Shadow Tower, there were five men making noises about how they might be the stuff of kings. Tormund was one, the Magnar another. The other three I slew. When they made it plain, they'd sooner fight than follow." John worries that the wildlings can't be trusted to keep the peace and obey the law.
"Don't worry about that," says Mance. "We definitely can't."
"And if we refuse?" asks John.
"Well, then I have my stoner garage band uncle, a.k.a. Tormund, blow the horn and take down the wall," says Mance, lying through his teeth, but John doesn't know that.
He considers destroying the horn then and there, But then God, aka George R. R. Martin, intervenes, and another horn sounds outside. John and Mance step outside to find the camp in an uproar.
"Outrider's horn," Tormin told Mance. "Something's coming."
Varamyr sat cross-legged on the half-frozen ground. His wolves circled restlessly around him. A shadow swept over him, and John looked up to see the eagle's blue-gray wings.
"Coming. From the east."
"It can't be the Walking Dead," Harma says. "They're to the north." "It can't be the others," says Mance. "They never come when the sun is up." "It's some secret third thing." Which is the Stannis motto at this point, I guess. Not the Faith, not the Old Gods, not the Lannisters, not the Starks. Secret third thing. Mance starts getting his people ready to fight, as literally only he can. Varamyr reports that Night's Watchmen on horseback are approaching. Mance accuses Jon of treachery, but Jon knows that Janno Slynt lacks the men, the means, and the balls to attack Mance like this. When the Watchmen come within visible range, for those of us without third eyes, Mance sees that Jon was telling the truth. These are men from Eastwatch. But they're not alone. A scout comes riding up declaring that a host of Iron Men has surrounded the camp. Mance rides off to meet them, asking Varamyr to protect Dala. Oh, and also kill Jon if he runs. Mance tries to lead his men in an arrowhead formation, but they quickly fall apart behind him. Jon took a step toward the tent, thinking of the Horn of Winter, but the Shadow Cat blocked him, tail lashing. The beast's nostrils flared, and slaver ran from his curved front teeth. He smells my fear. He missed Ghost more than ever then. The two wolves were behind him, growling.
"Banners," he heard Varamyr murmur. "I see golden banners. Oh."
A mammoth lumbered by, trumpeting a half-dozen bowmen in the wooden tower on its back.
"The king? No."
Then the skin changer threw back his head and screamed. The sound was shocking, ear-piercing, thick with agony. Varamyr fell, writhing, and the cat was screaming too. And high, high in the eastern sky, against the wall of cloud, Jon saw the eagle burning. For a heartbeat it flamed brighter than a star, wreathed in red and gold and orange, its wings beating wildly at the air as if it could fly from the pain. Higher it flew, and higher still. The scream brought Val out of the tent, white-faced.
"What is it? What's happened?"
Varamyr's wolves were fighting each other, and the Shadow Cat had raced off into the trees, but the man was still twisting on the ground.
"What's wrong with him?" Val demanded, horrified. "Where's Mance?"
"There," Jon pointed. "Gone to fight." The king led his ragged wedge into a knot of rangers, his sword flashing.
"Gone? He can't be gone, not now. It started."
"The battle?" He watched the rangers scatter before Harma's bloody dog's head. The raiders screamed and hacked and chased the men in black back into the trees. But there were more men coming from the wood. A column of horse. Knights on heavy horse, Jon saw. Harma had to regroup and wheel to meet them, but half of her men had raced too far ahead.
"The birth!"
Val was shouting at him. As if all that wasn't overwhelming enough, suddenly trumpets are blaring all over the place, further confusing and scattering the wildlings. The enemy cavalry charges forward. Jon doesn't know who they are any more than the wildlings do, and he tells Val to get back inside the tent. Jon sees Harma and Tormund's forces overwhelmed. He sees the attackers reel from the giants and mammoths. He sees women and children killed in the mayhem. He also sees hundreds more men emerge from the woods, bearing yellow banners with a red device, which Jon has never seen, but we have. The wildlings' numerical advantage is washed away by the attackers' superior arms, and when Mance himself is finally taken captive, the wildlings break and run for it. And through the smoke another wedge of armored riders came on barded horses. Floating above them were the largest banners yet, royal standards as big as sheets. A yellow one with long pointed tongues that showed a flaming heart, and another, like a sheet of beaten gold, with a black stag prancing and rippling in the wind. "Robert?" Jon thought for one mad moment, remembering poor Elwyn. But when the trumpets blew again and the knights charged, the name they cried was Stannis. Stannis! Stannis! Jon turned away and went inside the tent. And that is the synopsis for A Storm of Swords, Jon 10. What did you think of this one, sir?
Stannis! Stannis! Stannis!
Stannis!
Sorry. Got a bit carried away there.
Who can blame you?
Jon 10 is in many ways a transition chapter like many others in this stretch of the material. It definitely starts setting up several plot threads we will discuss into the next books. And George has to reconfigure his pieces at the wall from this ongoing war of attrition to its own court of intrigue. To accomplish that, he crashes Team Dragonstone right into this northern hinge of the world, forcing a reordering of the pawns and players. Basically, George took the soda can that is the story at the wall, shook it really, really hard, aka added some Stannis, and then opened the can. We'll see the mess that makes in the remaining Jon and Sam chapters, as well as into A Dance with Dragons.
Just the Mentos trick with Stannis. It makes exactly. Perfect sense. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. This is George kicking over his own game board. It's one of the biggest plot twists in the story. We spend so much of A Dance with Dragons just unraveling the implications. But what really makes Jon 10 such an exhilarating chapter is the execution. And that applies to the chapter as a whole, not just the climax. Although, holy shit, what a climax.
Mm-hmm.
Even before that, George demonstrates mastery of every element of his craft. He sets the grim, melancholy mood perfectly. He grounds us in the stakes, both politically and personally. He gives us our clearest insight yet into Mance Rayder, making him a really compelling figure, right before ushering him off stage with Stannis' arrival. Jon 10 is brain and brawn. It's the best of both worlds. It's a philosophical exploration of the meaning of kingship, and also a kick-ass rising action set piece about as perfectly paced and structured as I can imagine, without ever completely losing sight of Jonny Snow at the heart of it all. This is easily my favorite Jon chapter so far in the story, and it might be my favorite Jon chapter, period.
Hear, hear. Jon is a prisoner of fate. Or, well, at least a prisoner. There's a continuity from the last Jon chapter to this one, from an ice cell in which he can't stand or lie flat to a rusted cage being lowered into a bottomless pit of wind and ice. No matter what Jon does, he is trapped. Assassinate Mance Rayder? Dead. Fail to assassinate Mance Rayder? Also dead. Hell, he may just be dead the moment he steps into the Wildling camp. He's not just trapped physically, but socially. He's only a watchman to the free folk, and to the watch, he's just a wildling. Ensnared in political contradiction that he can't untangle himself from, a trap that will still hold him well into A Dance with Dragons. But Jon is also trapped by his identity, and sometimes by the lack thereof. He feels he may be doomed to his fate as a bastard, being as conniving and self-interested as the tales say. He also feels trapped by Rob's shadow, and the young wolf casts a very long shadow.
Which is exactly how Stannis feels about Robert.
Mm-hmm.
Something that Stannis tries to take advantage of when he meets Jon, but fails spectacularly, as we'll talk about in the next Jon chapter. Speaking of Stannis, the opening line of this chapter describes the wind blowing from the east, which is the direction Stannis is coming from. Like the winds of winter are his heralds, racing ahead of his army. And that's another way in which Jon is trapped. It doesn't matter what he says or does to Mance, turns out, because Stannis is already on his way from Eastwatch, having presumably landed sometime while Jon was on ice. And it's presumably from Stannis' men that Jon learns Robb is dead. Although we never see that happen, when Sam 4 starts, Jon already knows. And there's a hideous irony to him thinking here about Robb as a hero king who will surely outshine Jon's inherent bastard treachery, when we know that Robb is already dead, and he was betrayed mostly by the Trueborn. Catelyn worried that Jon would betray Robb, or that his children would. But even after joining the Night's Watch and supposedly putting all other ties aside, Jon remains loyal to House Stark, in his mind and in his heart. But they're the only faction unavailable to him here. Like, there's the Watch, the Wildlings, even the Throne is represented in the form of Stannis. Everyone is here to make a claim on Jon's loyalty, except the Starks, except the ones he wants.
Oh, that's great. Jon is bound to the whims of Janos Slynt and Alistair Thorne. Though, as Jon deduces, Janos Slynt doesn't have the wits to argue his way out of a paper bag. This assassination plan is clearly Thorne's doing. Confirmed by Thorne's appeal to duty and honor to give the appearance that Jon is proving his loyalty to the Watch. While Slynt and Thorne have formed an anti-Jon Snow coalition here, I think you can see how Slynt is just a useful idiot for Thorne. Like, Slynt is obviously a buffoon in every last way. Some of his bullshit about how Mance is parlaying out of fear of Slynt's arrival is legit comedy cold, I'd say. If you told the King Beyond the Wall that, he might actually die from laughter, which is a far better plan for assassination than the one they've cooked up. But Slynt has just enough bullet points on his resume to project authority and institutional competence, and Thorne uses that to his advantage while Janos is around. Everyone despises Alistair Thorne, especially any recruits from, say, the last decade. He'd have no chance at winning a Night's Watch election. Slynt, however, offers Thorne a path to command, albeit indirectly. But as soon as Slynt is out of favor and openly defiant of that Night's Watch command, it will make sense for Thorne to quite literally step aside when Jon orders Slint's death. Thorin was very much a low-key dungeon boss for Jon in earlier Game of Thrones, playing the role of Arlie Ermey from Full Metal Jacket, drilling the boys and making their lives a living hell. George does a great job here of deepening Alistair, and that will continue into A Dance with Dragons, making clear he isn't just some chump who served an early story purpose, but someone who can plot and scheme and play the game to some extent. This also works as a red herring, as we'd expect someone like Thorin to be more likely to shiv Jon Snow in the back, as opposed to someone whose nickname is the Old Pomegranate. Both Slint and Thorin wanted to just let Jon rot away, but it's Aemon who kicked up a stink about it, because, you know, Targaryens gotta back Targaryens. Maester Aemon doesn't have that much time left in the story, and we know the fall of his own house is something that weighs on him going back to his chat with Jon in A Game of Thrones. He chose duty over love then, but in his last bits here at Castle Black, he's able to not only do his duty, but protect family in a way he was denied during Robert's Rebellion, which is pretty nice.
Jon thinks about that a little bit here. Aemon Targaryen, he thinks, a king's son and a king's brother and a king who might have been. Which is a great little bit. He's thinking, you know, he's trying to defend Maester Aemon from Janos Slynt. And in a way, you know, the king who might have been is the most important part of that, because Aemon has nothing to do with being a king's son. You know, that's not a decision he made. He was just born. But he chose to be a king's brother instead of a king. He chose to be a king who might have been. And that reflects a level of self-control and a level of insight and some humility that someone like Janos Slynt is never going to possess. But it also ties into the chapter as a whole. This is a chapter about the meaning of kingship, as we're going to get to Jon and Mance talking about what makes a true king, and then Stannis showing up with the antithesis, I guess, to the thesis man puts forward. And now Aemon is tied into this, like these paths not taken. You know, Mance is not going to be king, at least not in the way he is now after this chapter. Stannis is making an attempt to revitalize campaign, but I think he'll still end up a king who might have been a king's brother instead of a king. So even just this little bit ties so effectively into that. And yeah, we see Jon pulled out of the ice cell, only to face what seems like it might be an even worse fate, you know, torture and death at the hands of the wildlings. Just a very kind of bitter, cynical view of what it means to be in service to the Night's Watch. Because it's not just that he's being forced to do this thing, it's that, as Alistair Thorne realizes, he has to do it, otherwise he'll prove them right. Like, he has to follow the orders, otherwise, haha, you are just a traitor, you won't do it what we're telling you to do. And yeah, I love the bit where Jon realizes, yeah, this is your idea, isn't it? Janos Slynt, it's not just that Thorne is pulling the strings, it's that Slynt clearly does not realize that. Like, this is not like a deal with the devil he's made with Alistair Thorne. It's like, you give the ideas, I'm the front man. No, Slynt thinks he's both the idea man and the front man, clearly, and is too dumb to realize that Thorne is manipulating him and has this prior relationship with Jon Snow. And it is very clever what Thorne does, is he weaponizes Jon's vows against him, forces him to prove his place among the crows and not the wildlings. And he takes advantage of the kind of suicidal romanticism we see even among the best of the Night's Watch. Corrin Halfhand, as Jon thinks here, told him that his life meant no more than his honor so long as the realm was safe. And yeah, you can see that kind of running parallel to what we were talking about in the last chapter with Jaime trying to define himself among the Kingsguard. Jon's going through a similar problem here. He's being forced to kill part of himself, and basically everything he's done so far in this book and the last book is being turned against him. His time with Corrin, his time with the Wildlings, his return to the Night's Watch. He's being forced into this crucible, this pressure chamber of choice among all of them.
Jon's jaunt out to the Wildling camp through the bloodied, corpse-ridden battlefield is a meta preview of what's to come. Before Jon can get to Mance's tent and set up A Dance with Dragons, he's got to walk through a feast for crows. Crows and ravens, including ones that keep saying, "Snow, Snow." Who says we've seen the last of Bran in this book?
Especially when they start saying, "Jon, brother, buddy, you love me." That's how we'll know. And yeah, Jon is not only a preview of everything that's to come, but just of everything, a review of everything that's happened so far. This is Jon forced to see his own grisly work. You know, people were dying at a distance in the last Jon chapter because of the sheer height of the wall, their advantage. But now he's literally on the ground. He's in the muck with those corpses, and it's about to get a whole lot worse.
Yeah, lucky for Jon, though, it's Tormund and not literally anyone else who comes to meet him as he enters the camp. Chicago Bulls play-by-play man Stacey King uses the acronym KYP, Know Your Personnel, One of the key aspects of leadership, or even just being effective at your job, is understanding who the people are around you, their strengths, their weaknesses, their vulnerabilities. John knows Tormund, and he knows how to endear himself to Tormund, making him smile out of the gate despite spending the last week fighting on opposite sides of the battle. It's honestly a minor W for John that he isn't killed upon approaching the camp, and being forward and honest to Tormund in a way that Tormund would respect goes a long way towards that. This is a game John's going to play at a much higher level in the next books, and you can argue he failed at it at the end of A Dance with Dragons.
It's a tough border to cross. We're seeing definitely, I think you're right, like a little preview of those dynamics here. And I love that Tormund not only welcomes John, it's like there's not even any surprise. It's like there's nothing John has to get past, no skepticism, no bitterness. It's like, welcome back, buddy. What's been up? And it's in part, of course, because Tormund is this Dionysus figure. You know, he wants to fuck, he wants to eat, he wants to drink, he wants to tell stories, and he really doesn't care who he does it with. If it's a wildling, if it's a Night's Watchman, whatever, let's party. And you know, Harma calls him crow lover a little later in the chapter. You always get the sense he's always been soft as far as the kind of more hard-edged wildlings are concerned. He wants to hang out with everybody. But it's also, I think, a hint at a deeper wisdom with Tormund that we're going to see more of in A Dance with Dragons when he's in charge of the remaining wildlings north of the wall. You have to live it up because death is always coming. You have these corpses all around them, and Jon and Tormund both know they easily could have been among those corpses. Jon thought in his last chapter about the one Night's Watchman who'd gotten hit with the arrows kind of accidentally, it seemed like. That could just have easily been Jon. Tormund could just as easily have been in the tunnel fighting Donal Noy, and they wouldn't be standing here. They know only chance has saved them, and it might not save them tomorrow, so why squabble when you don't have to? Why be bitter when you don't have to? Why not share a drink for the people who are gone, who are waiting for us to beyond the curtain? And you see that when they talk about Donal and Mag, and Tormund's talking about we're gonna make a song about them and share this drink. And it's again, it's that romanticism of death, of the beautiful, glorious death worthy of song. But when Slint and Thorne were trapping Jon into that death, it was that cynical edge, like I said, we're gonna take that romanticism and use it against you, we're gonna trap you with it. And with Tormund, it's like this little pocket of liberation. It's this, we carve out a little space where we don't have to fight each other and we can honor our dead together. And it's all the more powerful because of how fragile it is.
In George's saga, the story at the wall is one of existential danger, the others descending down on all peoples and kingdoms to consume and enthrall them. What the folks of Westeros need to do is bind together, friend and foe alike, and declare their shared humanity together to defend against the White Walkers. To that end, I really like how the items Tormund and Jon discuss run tangent to that theme, even though on its face they are just kind of giving a recap of the battle. How many dead, what resources were used, you know, box score type of shit. But when they talk about Mag the Mighty fighting Donal Noy, we see the pretense of status and title stripped away, thanks to the Great Leveler, aka Death. Mag, the last king of a dying race, and Donal Noy, a one-armed yeoman forever in service. Two different types of people, at opposite ends of social structures, yet their fate is the same. Among the things that bind us all is that our time on this planet is finite. The other discussion point is that of Ygritte's death, which George has Jon work through in a very fascinating way. Jon didn't kill Ygritte, no, but he says his brother did, which implies a certain intimacy and perhaps complicity with Ygritte's killer. And not long after that, Jon finds himself thinking of Longspear Ryke with excessive fondness, hoping that Rick or Ryke had found some joy with Munda. He too thinks of Rick as a brother, maybe not in the same way the Watch means it, but Jon has expanded his perception of kin to include kith. All men must die, yes, Valar Morghulis, but all men are brothers. Valar Isi Lakia? That's per a free Valyrian online translator.
Works for me, absolutely. That's a great way of putting it, that the universality of death is kind of what allows them to see what they have in common. And specifically around this conversation of the custom of bride stealing, which Jon recoiled from in earlier books. And like, that's emblematic of the differences between our culture. That's why we can't get along. That's why we're always going to be different from each other. He had those conversations with Ygritte and even before Ygritte. And now it's like Jon doesn't have those thoughts at all. And all he can think is, I hope they get something out of it. Someone's got to get something out of this somewhere. Anybody. Like, I love they, not even just the wildlings or just the Watch. Someone somewhere has to be happy. And that speaks to his development, as does Ygritte's voice kind of popping up unprompted in Jon's head now, kind of speaking on behalf of what he's learned from the wildling ways. That alone exemplifies different cultures coming together. It's not only has Jon met another way of life, but now that way of life is inside his head, is one of the voice that, you know, Ned is always speaking in Jon's head, and now Ygritte is too.
Entering the camp here is a time capsule of sorts, going way back to the first chapter in A Storm of Swords for John, when he walked through Mance's camp up near the Milkwater and experienced culture shock. Here now, it's deja vu, giving the reader a sense of fulfillment that we've come full circle, kind of like John returning to the Wall. And this is an important comparison because Mance's army is as much a mobile village as a war camp. Women, children, and animals are all along for the ride. Mance awaits John at his tent, flanked by Harma Dogshead and Varamyr Sixskins. Varamyr, of course, gives us a glimpse into Warging that'll be expounded upon in the A Dance with Dragons prologue, while Harma acts as a reminder of the gender parity among the free folk. Her vicious attitude and history with the Watch is a reminder that it's important to support women's wrongs as much as women's rights.
Definitely a voice Mance has to balance in council, like everyone else. And we see that here, the many faces of Mance Rayder, all the kind of ambiguities and contradictions he has to bring together in his own personality as much as among his people, who are, of course, many different peoples that he has brought together as one. And we see him right away kind of trying to weigh those opposites. Like, you must be either very brave or very stupid, Jon Snow. It's like he's publicly giving himself permission to either kill or spare Jon, right? Like, he's laying the groundwork. Mm-hmm. You're very stupid, that means I'm going to kill you. You're very brave. That's him trying to save face in a way that maybe I can leave this guy alive. He's very courageous. Would any of us be brave enough to do this? Maybe he's got some balls. And I love how Jon kind of takes part in that kind of gamesmanship. He kind of has a sense for how Mance talks by now, you know, all the riddles and all the tricks, the tricksy bird, as Tormund mm-hmm. called Mance earlier, that John confirms his loyalty to the Watch, but only as a question. I'm wearing a black cloak. What else would a man of the Night's Watch wear? Kind of a little Socratic dialogue that John's getting into with Mance there. It's the way Mance talks. And we see him having to kind of navigate the rest of Mance's sidekicks, and they're arranged nicely. You have like Harm as kind of the political foe, mm-hmm. the one who has this this beef with the Watch, this grudge against the Watch, and Varamyr is this other side of the story entirely, the magical side. But Mance has leveraged them all. Even though Harm is kind of out of control, Mance is using her as like an offensive lineman, very kind of useful to get your foes off the. And Varamyr is Mance is using him as a spy, which is a really good use of your skin changers, as he says. So you're not fooling me about how many men you've got there. I know you have like 12 orphans left. That's how you're running things. So can't hide anything from Mance. So even though we haven't seen much of him, it's a good kind of, you get a sense of how his leadership probably operates in general, just from a little scene like this.
Once inside the tent, George births two more A Dance with Dragons storylines, Dala's baby and the fate of Val, the Nada princess of the Wildlings. That's all stuff for later books, but I return to my analogy about the shaken pop can. George has all these ingredients in play, and he's about to explode them out after Stannis takes the Wall.
Dala is used very effectively, very kind of bluntly in this scene. You know, she gets her only dialogue here. She's not a fleshed out character like Mance himself or even Val that we get more of in A Dance with Dragons. She kind of serves this purpose of the embodiment of what Mance is fighting for. Here's how you know Mance is an authentic guy who's not posturing, that he has this vulnerability, this family life he wants to take care of, this kind of sense of the people he's trying to protect. And then we have Jarl is brought up, Val's boyfriend who died climbing the Wall in an earlier Jon chapter. And he's this reminder of what they've lost. Gives you a sense of a threat towards Dali even before she dies, that it's easy to lose what you're fighting for. The Wildlings have already lost a lot of what they're fighting for in this campaign. And John is just, he walks in here and he's just realizing just how shitty this is. And it's a great case of the POV structure. Like, if you just heard about Jon Snow, this guy who went into Mance Rayder's tent and killed him right in front of his wife as she was giving birth, you'd be like, that's the worst guy ever. And now we're in his thoughts and he's like, yeah, this is, it might be better to die than to actually go through with this. Like, is this keeping my vows? No, this is selling my soul, which again feels like how Jaime kind of talked about the Kingsguard vows.
It's not the wildling babes that catches Jon's eye though, but the big black horn, mm-hmm. 8 feet tall and decorated with runes. Mance claims it to be the Horn of Jaramun, or the Horn of Winter, the one that will knock down the Wall in a single toot. Being rereaders with over a decade's worth of fan investigation, we know that this horn, doomed to be burned by Melisandre, is not the Horn of Winter. It's most definitely an ancient horn that maybe possesses magical qualities, but we will probably never know. The actual horn, we think, is the one Sam has, ironically on its way to Castle Black right now, though it will be soon departing south with him. This game of which horn is the real one actually reminds me a lot of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade and the Holy Grail riddle. The grail was not the intricately ordained golden chalice, but a humble cup made of clay, just as the real horn with Sam is a small, broken, inconspicuous thing. So it's a fake, but why is Mance faking it? Well, he's desperate. Not desperate to defeat the Watch, no, but to put the wall between his people and the others who harry and torment them. The wall is his best defense against the others, just as it is for the Seven Kingdoms. Mance lays it out flat. Eventually, with the numbers that the Free Folk have and the numbers that the Night's Watch doesn't, eventually they will get through and enough of their people will get south of the wall. But that will cost blood and lives, lives that are precious and can be weaponized by the others. When Mance talks about his losses, it's not the 200 men he's lost here at Castle Black, but the hundreds, maybe thousands, lost to the others over the years and on this expedition south. Begrudgingly, Mance admits that not even he, with all his skills and tact and songs, can withstand them, and thus he needs to be Moses for his people, demanding John let his people go through the wall. Something John may acquiesce to if he was given any actual power to negotiate such terms. Mance's humility in the face of death and his desperation to see his people saved reflects well on the king beyond the wall. John asks whether he is a true king, and to me, Manu, it seems he's a king in all the ways that matter, crownless and throneless though he may be. And while he's willing to prostrate himself in front of the watch, he's not willing to abandon his beliefs about kneeling. Admirable quality that we will discuss in the paradigm of applied ethics once Melisandre starts forcing her Rollo hegemony on the defeated wildlings. Also, we also need to highlight one of George's most memorable sayings in this chapter. Sorcery is a sword without a hilt. There is no safe way to grasp it. Perfectly memorable and perfectly encapsulates George's approach to writing mysticism into his story. If it is a power that extends beyond man's capacity for reason or science, it should not only be unknowable, but perhaps fickle or unwieldable in the absolute sense. George is very keen on not having magic be an answer to the conflicts in his story. Often, they tend to complicate it further, raising ethical questions about power and means. The dragons are perhaps the best example, especially in light of the Drogon plot in A Dance with Dragons. Drogon and his brothers might be the means in which Dany retakes the kingdom, but they are forces of death, a dreaded shadow that only heralds woe, as the sheep and perhaps families of Meereen will know soon enough. But I think what I love most about this quote is just how malleable it is. You can replace sorcery with any number of things. Lies, religion, revolution, all hiltless swords that can be dangerous to those that wield it as much as those whom it is being wielded against. It's one of those sayings that has found its way into my daily vocabulary in that regard.
Yeah, that's great. It's like it's pared down to be absolutely perfect, like word for word. Mm-hmm. Like that's George just like scientifically made it as applicable as he could. You can talk about a fire that way, which certainly applies to Stannis and to Dany coming behind him. And I think it's good that George captured it so well and insists, as you said, on not letting kind of magic smooth over storytelling difficulties, because the horn, the presence of the horn here throws us into this whole new context, and I think George doesn't want to make it feel too forced. Like, now we have what seems, at first, like the most important magical artifact since the dragon eggs. This is something that could destroy a hinge of the world, reshape everything politically and magically. It would certainly draw everyone's attention to the north. Tywin's not going to ignore what's going up there after that. But of course, it's not actually any of that. When we come back, and knowing that this is not actually the real Horn of Winter, it just adds a layer to Mance saying that he can lie like anyone else. He's doing it right now. He's a Bard King. That's Mance Rayder. He's a storyteller. He's always showing off for everyone at once. And in that way, Mance is like John, caught between worlds, trying to cross a bridge no one else has managed to cross. Like you were saying earlier, he's both a conqueror and refugee, and he has these weaknesses hidden kind of inside his strengths as he unpacks for us over the course of this scene. Like, he's only here because the others kicked his ass even more comprehensively than he is kicking the Watch's ass right now. He needs the wall. He needs the wall to hold the others back. But, and as you were saying about like the kind of the reason he can't admit his desperation, he can't admit that to his followers, because as he says, they follow fighters. They're not going to follow someone who tells them that our fighting strength doesn't matter, and now we have to go hide with our enemies and hope they're nice to us. Like, no one, even if that is logistically, rationally what's happening, No one's getting behind a guy who's saying that. And Mance knows that, especially if you're just coming down from the Night's Watch himself. Like, if you're the average wildling, you might think this was all a con by Mance Rayder to get us to subordinate ourselves to the Night's Watch, unless he shows them that he can fight. And Mance also needs to perform strength for the Watch so they take him seriously. Otherwise, why would they ever let him and his people through? All this military gamesmanship, these political negotiations, what we might call the Game of Thrones, all of that is happening under the shadow of the apocalypse, which is how George has always talked about it. And in that way, I think Dala, with her famous line about sorcery being a sword without a hilt, I think she does speak for the author, that what matters most is saving humanity. And we're not going to do that with tools that require us to become something inhuman. If we give ourselves up, then we've let the others south of the wall by becoming them. So let's not do that. But then what comes next, as John thinks, which is a big question, I think, throughout A Song of Ice and Fire, is what happens after you save the day? I think we've seen that right from the start of the story with Robert's Rebellion and now the present day when no one knows what to do with the victory that they won. And then I was kind of going through John's kind of paranoid thoughts about what must come next if we let them through the wall. And I was thinking about, like, well, why not? Like what John thinks about giants camping in the ruins of Winterfell. Okay, well, you know, no one else is there right now because they're ruins. Would you rather have the Boltons there? That's who comes next. And he thinks of chariots in the Barrowlands. Is it a zoning issue? What's the problem with that? Daughter stolen? Yeah, I understand why that would frighten people. But Ramsay's doing that right now, south of the wall, and he's not a wildling. Oh, we're going to have cannibals in the Wolfswood? Well, there will be when Stannis gets there and his men are starving. Cannibals show up in the Wolfswood, but not the wildlings. I think that's very deliberate on George's part. It clears away those kind of easy answers to the question Mance is posing. Jon can't rely on that, and he doesn't want the reader to rely on that either. So we get to the more important question, are you a true king? And that's when Mance gives his big monologue, kind of the spotlight goes to him more than any other time in the story. And yeah, I agree with you. Mance's answer is right, that those external symbols, the crown, the thrones, the titles, they don't matter if they don't reflect anything. He has this integrity that is rooted in authenticity, and his authenticity is rooted in action. Everyone is here because they know who he is from watching what he does. He does it himself, and Mance takes pride in that. I gotta think Davos would approve that this is a king protecting his people, as Davos said in his last chapter, that he's not interested in conquest, he's not interested in plunder, he's interested in keeping these people safe. And in a way, he becomes the anti-Stannis. Like, there's that line about not caring which brother was born first. That's a very pointed line given Stannis and Renly in the last book. But at the same time, Mance is still always difficult to pin down. He's still slippery. He's still kind of dodging the actual question John is asking. Maybe kind of John was asking in kind of a clunky way, are you a true king? But what John is really asking, he's trying to approach Mance from the POV of the Northmen, who are his original community. And there John has a point that it does take work to integrate, which Mance is not willing to do or even talk about. Like, Mance, practically speaking, you know that even if it's unfair for the people on the other side of the wall to have reservations, those reservations still exist, and you have to acknowledge that if you're going to try to be neighbors with these people. But Mance is right to stick up for his people, that they shouldn't be subordinated to survive or lose their culture in order to survive. And as I was reading this argument, I was thinking that there is kind of a bigger point beyond both of them, which is that when John thinks about, can we trust you to, you know, obey the law? And Mance says, no, we're not going to pay your taxes. But I'm wondering, wait, what law at this point? What taxes? There is no one in charge on the other side of the wall. Winterfell has been burned down. Ramsay's running around doing Ramsay shit. The Crown put Roose Bolton in charge, but he can't get back as long as the Ironborn hold Moat Cailin. And also, oh yeah, the Ironborn. They just lost their king, but they still hold a chunk of the North. So think about it. Even if Mance was telling the truth completely, and even if Janos Slynt was willing to cut a deal with him, say a rock falls on his head and he gets a whole new personality, and even if Stannis wasn't about to show up and kick the game board over anyway, there is no practical way to get this done right now, because there is no one who can speak on behalf of the Stark North, which is exactly what Stannis wants from Jon later. So naturally, that's when Stannis shows up.
Yeah, in the parlance of Bob Dylan, or Jimi Hendrix if you prefer, outside in the cold distance, a shadow cat did growl, many riders were approaching, and the horns began to howl. All along Mance Rayder's camp, confusion starts to run amok. George has always excelled at evoking emotion, from the dread of the Red Wedding to the surprise of the Purple, the chest-thumping victory at Astapor to the cruel jaws of defeat for Oberyn Martell. In John 10, George makes the last act of his chapter one of confusion, a literal fog of war. Who's attacking? From where? Is it the others? Is it the Watch? As confused as the Wildlings are, John is even more confused. If it's the Watch, they sure as hell didn't tell him about it. And, well, the Watch, or the Northern Lords even, don't use trumpets, so what the actual fuck? It's one of those bits that necessarily can't work the same on reread, as we know who it is and why. But we can see how deftly George works in the details, from those trumpets to Orel's eagle burning alive, to the steel and armor and heavy horse too good to be that of the Watch, even the better provisioned men of Eastwatch. The Wildlings do put up a fight, or try to at least, mustering what strength they have. Specifically, the bit about the giants on mammoths meeting the heavy horse head-on feels ripped from Pelennor Fields, mm-hmm. where the Herodrim and Rohirrim clash in similar form. George, of course, is not content with just having a big confused battle that will reshuffle the War of Five Kings into a new form. No, he has to go back to his favorite trick, the juxtaposition of life and death. Amidst this chaos, where women and children and being caught in the stampede of opposing armies, Dala goes into labor, and John goes into the tent to watch after her. It's shades of Dany's birth from A Game of Thrones, though this monster will fare quite a bit better than hers. Or we hope she will.
We certainly hope so. And yeah, so now we get Stannis' big intervention, which is the kind of thing, I think, if you're, you know, looking for YouTube hits, you call it a Deus Ex Machina. Mm-hmm. But it's also an answer to the dilemma that John was just facing with what to do about Mance and what the kind of the political challenge Mance poses. Stannis is kind of the South's answer to that. And it's also, you know, thinking about Deus Ex Machina somewhat literally as the idea of a divine intervention that reflects this kind of power structure and reality that is beyond the mundane lives of the people involved. It's almost literal because there is kind of this godlike element, especially when the bird catches on fire. But even before that, like that confusion you're talking about and how they're listing off who this could be, it feels strange and supernatural. Like there's a reason that they compare it to, they think it's the others at first or the whites, and then they realize that makes no sense. But it does feel like that. It's like a version of the others that come when the sun up. It's the day others. They're even coming from the east, which is, of course, the direction the sun rises. And yeah, it's such a propulsive, well-written scenery. You just get the sense of rising excitement and motion and all the details and everyone running around. And you get these magical powers involved with Varamyr's eyes kind of guiding the battle, but also the mundane military realities of people just running off in the wrong direction every which way. And this is where the Wildlings' lack of discipline, something that I think is really admirable when put, as Mance did, in terms of freedom and self-expression, this is where it comes back to haunt them. This is something that John kind of hinted at earlier. This is why you can't actually win this war against anyone but my gang of Dickensian orphans, because the Wildlings are not prepared to fight on the ground against an unexpected cavalry force. Like, even when Mance is personally present, he can't do it. Like, he tells his men to form a wedge behind him, and he rides off, and they immediately scatter in every direction. And I was thinking, who knows? Did Mance even train them to form a wedge, keep the arrowhead around him? Maybe that was just the first time he asked, and he just kind of, in this panic, he kind of slipped back into Night's Watch mode and assumed they would know what that meant. Some of them start slipping away into the woods. Others are just going this way and that and fighting their own battle. And you see that for all their numbers and their strength when they were fighting the Night's Watch, the Wildlings are ultimately less than the sum of their parts. Without Mance's personal presence, as we saw with Renly, there's kind of nothing keeping everyone together. And that reveals the fatal weakness of Mance's campaign, because even if they'd gotten past the Night's Watch, there is a whole continent on the other side. And sure, you know, Stannis does have an unusually good strategic mind, like using the Night's Watch to lure out Harma and then catch her on the flanks. Not, you know, if he was going up against Janos Slynt, he probably wouldn't have thought of that. And like I was saying, there's all that chaos in the north. That's very convenient right now from the Wildling perspective. But even so, you know, Wyman Manderly still has armored cavalry. So do the Dustins and the Rice Wells, and so will Roose Bolton when he makes it home. So if this didn't happen now, it was going to happen at some point, and the Wildlings aren't ready for it. Stannis' force is the opposite of that. It's pure discipline. This is the benefit of his rigid top-down model, which in most of the story George frames as a problem. Like, that's why Stannis can't make as many allies as he wants to, because it's my way or the highway. Here, though, we see this. It really helps. Like, his men are not going to break. They're not going to run, even though they're deep into enemy territory and fighting, you know, giants raiding mammoths. There is that sense that this is where being a hard-ass all the time does come in handy. But then there's the flip side of that, that this is also, this more than anything isn't about discipline. This is about arms and armor. This is about a technological gap that has been created by power, because it is, even if the wildlings were all together around Mance and had discipline, it's basically impossible for them to fight Stannis' men when they have armored on horseback and they're carrying around castle forged steel. Like, it doesn't matter how brave the wildlings are. It wouldn't matter how disciplined they are. It's, there's this gap that is impossible for them to get past. It reminds me of Pizarro taking down so many Incas with just a few men because he had guns and they didn't. There's that colonial edge to this that's going to become a lot more pronounced in A Dance with Dragons. And there are civilians here, which is something that George never lets you forget, that even though this is an armed camp and an invasion force from the perspective of the South, this is also a refugee camp. And the cruelty of that is underlined in A Dance with Dragons when George really lingers on the destruction of a people, and not just a people, like I said, many peoples. So we get this ambiguity. We had an ambiguity with Mance, and then we have this different kind of ambiguity, this moment as Stannis comes out of the fog with his banners. Is this his redemption, or is this a new kind of downfall? Like, is he here to be the solution, or is he just a whole new problem? And the answer, as usual with him, is both at once. And I love the kind of bittersweet irony that the wildlings, the only part of this battle they win, are with the giants and the mammoths, because those are the remnants of the old world that are being swept away. We saw that with Mag the Mighty. We'll see a particularly brutal example of it with Godri the Giant Slayer, one of Stannis' knights who ran down a giant fleeing from the battle and cut off his head. I, the Giant Slayer. It's like, you know, shooting a bear that's drinking from a pond and then taxiderming it so it's like big, fierce with claws. Like, yeah, that's how I killed it. Something that is totally unique to Team Stannis, something that wouldn't have happened if the wildlings had this disaster with any place else, with anyone else, is what happens to Varamyr. And that is just, like, if I can pull out one incredible moment from this action set piece, that's just such a great, yeah, it just ramps up the tension to this whole new level. When you see that bird across the sky, reminds me of the opening line of Gravity's Rainbow, a screaming came across the sky. It's like that bird turns into like a missile for a second. It's like a banner in the sky. Like, this is R'hllor marking its territory, marking its presence in the north. Very kind of anti-old gods. That's where the wildlings and the Northmen have something in common, this connection to the old gods like Varamyr has. And now this is Melisandre's first moment of saying, not welcome anymore. This is my territory now. It's thrilling because it's so confusing, because we're like, what? Especially when that happens to Varamyr, the first time through, you're like, what is happening? What is this? Every fragmented image is flying past. We're reading faster and faster. And this is similar to, very similar, like you said, to the Miri Mazdur stuff in book one with Dany. It's even like the last line of this chapter is like identical to that, like that Dany chapter where she's giving birth as the Khalasar flies apart, just like the wildlings are flying apart here. And the last line is like, I think it's Ser Jorah took Dany inside the tent, and this is Jon turning when it's like the exact same line. George definitely clearly going for that comparison. But always with comparisons like that, the differences become more interesting. They stand out more. You know, what happened with Miri Mazdur was because Dany embraced sorcery, and Dala said that, you know, sorcery is a sword without a hilt. She makes the opposite choice, but she dies anyway. And that just makes it all the more bitter and all the more sad. And the other part of the story this reminds me of, besides the Miri Mazdur stuff, is the Blackwater. That was the big action climax at the end of the last book. And now we get this one, but now, like, the sides are reversed, because at the Blackwater, Stannis was the one who got his ass kicked by a cavalry charge out of nowhere, in which everyone was confused and didn't know who it was. Now he's the one leading that cavalry charge. And we finally get the reveal of that at the end, with his men holding his banners and shouting his name, and this has been given so much great build-up to make it as satisfying as it is. Outside the chapter, we've been talking about it in the Davos chapters, the kind of the build-up to the reveal that this is what Davos wanted Stannis to do, instead of burning his nephew. But even within the chapter, it's slow-rolled with such confidence on George's part. Like, okay, it's not the others, it's not Janos Slynt. Okay, those are Cotter Pike's men, but it's not just Cotter Pike's men, because then his men come out of the woods, and it's like a host of Iron Men, and you're comparing it to Hendrix. It does have, it has that intense, like, rock and roll energy, like I hear, I am Iron Man. This is the moment that Stannis has been trying to get to his entire life. The banners blazing, the trumpets blaring, everyone shouting his name. This is the moment where he doesn't feel like a footnote in someone else's history book. This is the moment where he feels like it's a chapter about me. I'm the main character of reality, the thing I could never be. And that's what makes it so funny when John sees his banners that he thinks, Robert? One of the funniest moments in the whole story for me, because the whole reason Stannis is like this, the whole reason he has this hole he wants to, his hole inside he wants to fill with a crown, is because Robert never loved him the way Stannis needed, and Robert rejected him even though Stannis did so much for him, and now that relationship is never going to be fixed. He's never going to get out of Robert's shadow. And even in his moment of triumph, when he's center stage and the whole story is having a big plot twist about him, even then John thinks of Robert first. Even though Robert's dead, still Stannis can't get past that. Like, the cherry on top of this whole action set piece is that George wrote this whole big, great, like, fantasy scenario for Stannis and then undercut him one last time on the way out. Nothing but praise for George, man. What a craftsman. What an artist.
Yeah, and that's, you know, excellent analysis, sir.
Thank you.
You know, that's something we're afforded to with, you know, our rereading eyes. But really quickly, I just want to talk about reading this the first time through, like 10, 15 years ago, whatever it was, like literally breathtaking, exhilarating stuff, because you could feel that even though you were kind of unclear what's happening, like everything's about to change here. Yeah. And I literally love everything that happens in the North from this point on, the story at the Wall, what'll happen at Winterfell. Like, that is the most George had these ingredients. I didn't think he could combine it into a good pizza, but somehow he did. And like, this is, you know, we all remember the Red Wedding, the Purple Wedding. There's all these memorable moments. There's no lack of them in A Song of Ice and Fire. But this one still sticks with me as much as those, because you can feel the weight of narrative shifting. This is like tectonic. This is an earthquake in a way that, you know, the Red Wedding and Purple Wedding are, but this almost feels like a different type of earthquake, like two different plates crashing into each other. And there's a certain excitement here that, you know, we're sober rereaders now, but I feel like we need to highlight just what kind of thrill this chapter was the first time going through it.
I'm glad you said that, because it really was. I remember that too. And it was the 1-2 punch of the shock of not seeing it coming, and then me thinking about it for a second, going, oh, of course, that's Stannis' guys. That's what Davos was doing at the end of the last thing. That makes total sense. And I was just, that combination is so satisfying. When you're shocked by something and then you realize it makes sense.
That's kind of how you describe the Red Wedding. It's like when that, figuring it out just as it's happening on page. And that's kind of what's happening here as well.
That's the masterclass. Like when George, right before they yell Stannis' name, when George writes the yellow banners, whose arms were those? It's like he's just teasing us. We're just about to get it. He's paced us so perfectly. And yeah, and I love what you said about, yeah, the two tectonic plates. Because I remember that the first time. I was just so thrilled by just the possibilities. Like, oh, anything can happen now. We've taken two storylines and thrown them at each other. It could be anything at all. And yeah, I love everything that follows from the North here on too. So that's part of the thrill, and I still feel it on reread. So moving on into foreshadowing and groundwork. One little bit I was thinking about on reread is that John gets pulled out of the ice cells here, where he was, you will die in here, John Snow, as Alistair Thorne says. And then, of course, John does die, at least temporarily, at the end of A Dance with Dragons. And I've read theories that maybe John's body will keep in the ice cells until Melisandre brings him back, or until he's brought back by whatever capacity. And I was just thinking about that in the context of how shitty the Night's Watch feels to John in this chapter. And it's so funny. Even when he dies, they're going to press gang him into service. Even when he dies, pull him right back out.
Well, it seems like the ice cells are also a sword without a hilt. They almost kill John here, but they may be the reason he survives his assassination attempt
later.
Ice
preserves, but fire consumes, as Maester Aemon says in A Feast for Crows. One other little bit of not actually foreshadowing, but kind of abandoned foreshadowing, is when Janos Lent says he'd like to hang Mance off the wall with a rope 100 feet long. George's original plan, as you can see in kind of the notes and early drafts and the stuff available at the Cushing Library, one of his earlier plans in A Dance with Dragons was to have Jon sentence Janos Lent to die by hanging. And so this, I assume, was him foreshadowing that. I'm really glad he made the decision to have Jon kind of tease that and then decide to execute Janos Lent personally with his sword, because it partially just makes for a great tense set piece, but also that's much more kind of true to Jon and to Ned and the whole Stark ethos. So good call.
Yeah. Ed, fetch me a rope doesn't sound as good. Part of me actually wonders if writing that Elaine chapter where Sansa thinks about someone should have cut off Janos Lent's head, whether that had any effect on Jon.
That's true. That's from book
George
one.
11.
Yeah. Damn.
George had 11 years to play with what he was going to do with the Dance with Dragons after this. So maybe that went into his head as well.
That's a good call.
So, moving into theory and discussion, we figure we'd talk a little bit about HBO's adaptation here, because while I do have a fair amount of issues generally with how they handle everything Mance and Stannis at the Wall, I think the actual arrival of Stannis at the camp was really well done. It has this really memorable shot of the two columns coming in basically enveloping the White Walkers. And it also does a good job of giving us kind of the revelation of Stannis and Davos. I love the two of them emerging out of the smoke, where Mance and Jon can see. And you can see them kind of rework a lot of the lines that are in this chapter into that conversation. I really love having the four-handed scene with Liam Cunningham and Stephen Delane and Kieran Hines, all together. The whole Mance's line about my people have bled enough, saying that in the context of Stannis's men mowing down Mance's wildling camp, I think that works really well. That's a great way of reworking a line to still give it teeth without it being in the same context. It's not him talking one-on-one with Jon. So I thought it's a pretty good scene overall. I think it's mostly kind of a what could have been if they had given us multiple seasons of Mance and Stannis and Davos all kind of in the same situation, in the same setting, and bouncing off each other a lot more than we actually got from the show.
Agreed across the board. I think Mance is one of those characters I feel like the show never quite got. And I sympathize because the point of him is that he's like a completely ordinary looking guy in the books who's, you know, gets by on his wits and his surprising skills. And that, I don't know if that would necessarily translate visually to the show, in which you want people to look more just iconic. Kieran Hines obviously is a great actor, but I think they never really tapped into like, kind of the layers of the slippery stuff I was talking about in this chapter, how Mance is kind of, even when he seems like he's being at his most authentic, he's still always lying about something. I think that's crucial to his character. But it's also less important if you're not going to do the whole him disguised as someone else thing,
which is
kind of the very kind of literalization of that aspect of Mance. So, you know, it's not like there's something that doesn't make sense later. That was just kind of a much more limited perspective on Mance. But yeah, that said, I think this was a really, really well done set piece in at the end of season four there. I love those kind of aerial shots of Stannis's horsemen moving in, those rigid lines. I think it sets up very well visually the kind of the dialectic between freedom and control going on here, that Mance's belief in his people and protecting them and keeping them safe and their dignity, that's what you love about him. But that's also in this moment a weakness, because it makes him vulnerable to someone who will just tell his men to shut up and go kill those guys, as Stannis does. And something that I like about this in the show and what we got from the Blackwater is that Stannis is actually present, which I think is a good decision on George's part to have Stannis not present at the Blackwater or in this chapter, because it emphasizes that he does lead from behind, as Tywin does. That's something that Beric and Thoros brought up, that both Stannis and Tywin on opposite sides of the war, what they have in common is they're at the back. Everyone else is risking their lives in front of them. But again, different needs from the show. You want the actor present, engaging physically, visually. You can, you know, see what's going on. So he does his little George Washington routine at the Blackwater. And then here, yeah, emerging from the smoke with Liam Cunningham and his theme playing. That is a great badass moment when the guy comes out with them and just gets run over by the horseman. And they don't even flinch, just walking straight ahead. Great stuff. And again, different logic between the media. I think it makes perfect sense for Davos to not be here in the books to indicate that Stannis is still kind of pissed off at him for going behind his back, and it keeps them separate. But if you're not going to do that whole plot in the show, having him here makes perfect sense. But yeah, I wish we'd gotten to see more of these actors, because there's a little bit later in Storm of Swords, Stannis mentions having had a lot of conversations with Mance, which you can't see in the books, obviously, because of the POV structure. But in the show, that would have been great. I would have loved to see those scenes.
Yeah, no, I think that's what we missed. I could do like four episodes of just like the Stannis Mance debates about ruling and kneeling and all that stuff. I would have really loved it. I think we might do a little bonus episode on how we would have adapted Feast and Dance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe down the road. One of the things I always thought they might do, at least maybe in that gap between season four and season five, is maybe have slide Davos into, maybe they send Davos to sneak what would be Sansa Stark out of Winterfell.
A smuggler.
Kind of
that
claim the veil.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I'm going to need you to be the smuggler one more time.
Yeah.
I already asked you to do it once more, but we're going to do it one more
time.
One last job.
Exactly.
That might have been my own wishes to see like Liam Cunningham alongside Sophie Turner and Alfie Allen and Michael McCallaton, who played Roose Bolton. We can talk about that later, but I think there was some possibility to do something interesting with Davos at the Wall. Not as happy with how things turned out, but all the stuff they did give us was pretty well acted and kind of well conceived for what they were doing, though that's you know, a whole other discussion.
Agreed, agreed. I look forward to it. That'll be great. And one, yeah, one little line I like from that, this scene in the show, when Stannis shows up at the Wildling camp, is when John says about Stannis, "I know he's the king. My father died for him." A line that I often forget is not from the books, because it's actually very perfect for all the characters involved. And that sets up a dynamic we'll be talking about more in the next John chapter, the kind of the possibility for John and Stannis to team up, and then the things that keep them from teaming up. That's gonna be a lot of fun to talk about. And I do think actually the show did a good job of that for the most part. I think that it wasn't always there in the specifics, but I think the show had a handle on what the John Stannis relationship was kind of all about and what they needed from each other.
Yeah, when I lament what happens to the plot at the North, it's basically that they just took Stannis off the board too soon, really. Because the stuff they were kind of cooking into season 5 with Jon and Stannis, like, for the most part, I'm like, this is pretty good. This is kind of what I would want or what I'd expect from the HBO team creating Game of Thrones, and thought they were doing well until, you know, the back half of season 5, basically.
Agreed, agreed. So that is going to wrap us up for this episode on A Storm of Swords, John 10. Thank you so much for listening. As always, if you want to drop us a rating or a review on your podcast app of choice, we always appreciate that. It helps us find new listeners. You can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/notacast, A-S-O-I-A-F, where our patrons get benefits including early access to our regular A Song of Ice and Fire episodes and exclusive episodes every month. You can follow us on social media at notacast, A-S-O-I-A-F, or shoot us an email at notacast, A-S-O-I-A-F, @gmail.com, and you can find me at Borquenton.
And I'm Manu at Manu Clear Bomb. You can find my coverage of The Lord of the Rings over at My Brother, My Captain, My Podcast.
So, coming up next on the Nauticast, next Fever Dream episode for our $5 and above patrons is going to be coming out next week. We're getting to the end of Fever Dream, George R. R. Martin's 1982 vampire novel, but never too late to jump in. I'll be covering chapters 32 and 33. A couple weeks after that will be my next Star Wars episode, carrying on with Empire Strikes Back, aka Episode 5, aka The Good One, finally getting to Cloud City and meeting everyone's favorite character, Lando. And then next time in A Song of Ice and Fire, it's A Storm of Swords, Arya 13, in which Arya runs into some old friends, in the way that Alistair Thorne is an old friend.
We'll mostly be debating how many fucking chickens there are in that inn for that Sandor Clegane to eat.
Not nearly enough is the only answer to that question. And speaking of old friends, we're going to be having on Andrew from the Scene of Ice and Fire podcast for that episode. That's going to be great. You two did great work on that podcast back in the day, back in the Heady Thrones heyday.
Yep.
So it's going to be terrific to get the gang back together for that. So thanks again for listening. We will see you next time in Westeros for A Storm of Swords, Arya 13.